Today's shiur, this alumni shiur, is going to focus on a topic that I've always been trying to discuss. And you guys are going to get it now, finally, after long last. I really meant to say a shiur like this, Hanukkah time, because I feel that's the appropriate time to talk about, you know, Torah and science and reconciling things. I think it's the right time to talk about it. But then the Mashgiach of the Mir Yeshiva went and he, you know, unfortunately he passed away. And I said a shiur about him instead. So we're doing it now because it's sort of like, you know, somewhere between an opportunity and an obligation here. Anyway, I really think, and we're going to deal, I'm going to deal directly with, I hold, is the most critical of all issues. And that's not exactly how you answer. That's not the topic. How exactly I answer this question, that question, that I'm not dealing with that. If anyone has questions, they could give me questions and I'll answer what I know how to answer, I'll answer. But that's the topic that I want to talk about. This is the topic I want to talk about. A certain perspective part of this. Okay. Now, just for starters, to like, you know, open things up, to open up the issues, I generally speaking, the, you know, one of the famous statements from Rabbi Soloveitchik about this, it's actually very interesting. I asked Rabbi David about it, and he said, I never heard the Rav say that, but a lot of people say it in his name. And the statement goes something on the lines of, the conflict between Torah and sciences started in the times of the Greeks, and it's there's a greater gap today between Torah and science than there was in the time of the Greeks. That's the famous quote. A lot of people have quoted it. I heard other people quote it. Again, Rabbi David says he's heard people quote it. He says, but I never heard Rabbi Soloveitchik say it. For the records, I found a version of this. Not that exact, you know, how would we call that, formula. And one of the appendices in Rabbi Meiselman's book. So it's in other words, in substance, it says the same thing. It's not that exact quote, does not exactly exist. Could be probable that Rabbi Soloveitchik said it over in that format somewhere else. But that's a well-known statement. Now, I can't resist, you know, always saying, why did Rabbi Soloveitchik say that? What's the pshat? Why did he say that there's a greater gap today than there was 2,400 years ago? 2,300 years ago? Why is there a greater gap? So my understanding of it is that, you know, see, Greek science and philosophy did not reject existence of the soul as a reality, as a fact. They did not. That a man has a soul was an accepted fact by everyone in the world until relatively recently. And I'm talking as a historian, but put my historian's hat on. But I mean relatively recently, I would say certainly until 1850 and probably significantly later. And that's a major statement. I don't want to get into the, you know, philosophy of it per se to explain why I consider that such a major statement. But that's a major statement. That's a major, major statement. Greek science and philosophy did not contest that a prophet should exist. They did not contest that there should be something that we call a prophet. They didn't argue about that. And these are not minor concessions in a philosophical fashion. Okay. Now, again, this is, I'm not going to, I'm gonna, we're going to go on. I'm just saying this statement from Rabbi Soloveitchik as a opener, just to understand, you know, to get a grasp on the complexity of the topic. I'm going to add into it a statement I heard from my brother-in-law. Worked for Aish about, I'd say, 15 to 20 years ago for a couple of years. And he had the opportunity, because of that, he had the opportunity to speak to Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, the Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, about the topic and about these topics, because he was asked a lot of difficult questions. And Rav Weinberg told him, it depends which question you're asking, but on questions about cosmology, about creation of the universe, Rav Weinberg told him, listen, that's not a question. In pure theory, we don't ask questions on that. And what Rav Weinberg meant by that, for the records, in my opinion, is there's a somewhat known midrash. The midrash says, "Vayichul shemayim va'aretz ad kan." Until here, kavod malachim, kavod elokim, haster davar. Until here, the honor of God is to keep things quiet. Mikan ve'elach. From here and on, it's kavod malachim, chalkar davar. It's an honor per se for the melech, for the king, to look into things. So there's certain questions that in theory, but you know, life is not theory. You know, life is not a test tube. I said, in theory, you shouldn't ask, as Rav Weinberg said. But if a person has a question, they certainly have to deal with it. There's no such thing as if you have a question, just sweep it under the carpet. Oh no, we don't ask questions. There's no such thing. That's an inaccuracy. So, you know, there's nothing wrong. When we have a question, there's nothing wrong with us. It's natural to ask questions. Jews like asking questions. And we have to deal, you know, we have to figure out the best way out to deal with things. Okay. So the topic that I want to focus on today here is what I call treating Torah as a reality. That's the topic, the specific issue that I want to discuss. Because I hold this is in terms of, you know, depth, core, baseline issue. This is driving everything. And what I mean by that is when you have a question, how are you treating the two different, you know, fields per se of study that you're looking at? How are you treating it? How are you looking at it? Where and what do we, you know, there is something, you know, the issue of we look at certain things as absolute reality and other things not, that the facts are, and we, you know, weave back and forth between this, they're historical facts that no one doubts, but we still don't relate to them as reality. That's the facts of life. You know, you never, you know, I've had a lot of, you know, as we call it, discussions, even heated discussions about different topics. I have never in my entire life had a heated discussion with anyone about Julius Caesar. Never. He's an important person. I never had Charlemagne. We've heard of Charlemagne? Charlemagne, we know who that was? Hopefully. Okay. Have you ever had a heated discussion with someone about Charlemagne? I haven't. Never. Never. You know, about Adolf Hitler, I can have a lot of heated discussions with a lot of people. Whatever. I mean, yes, obviously. But that doesn't mean they don't exist. But that's just like sort of indicative of how much of a reality do you look at this person as. When a person sees someone, something, an event as a reality, they can get pretty heated about it. When they're not relating to it as a reality, they're not as heated. Now, that's at more what I would call an emotional level, but in terms of what I would call an analytical, factual level, things are a little more complicated. I mean, I don't know, I'm about to diverge off into something that I'm pretty sure about, but not fully sure about. In other words, I know enough about what I'm talking about to be confident, but I'm not fully sure. I mean, I know a lot about history. How about that? I know a lot about, you know, lots of different parts of Torah. I know a lot about that. I'm going off into the sciences, which I haven't properly studied in a very long time. I mean, I dabble, as we say, especially in COVID corona. I've been dabbling. I've been happy to say that Rabbi Dr. Apfel has agreed with most of my theories and most of my prognoses. So I feel that shows I'm not, I mean, he's not, you know, he's not an infectious disease doctor, but he's a doctor, you know what I mean? And he's, as we'd say in yeshivish parlance, he's holding in the sugya. So it's sort of like this. It's a mistake to think that, you know, that bodies of fact and bodies of data and fact in almost any topic. Now, it could be in mathematics. There's no such thing as contradiction in body of facts. That could be. But once I'm outside of mathematics, that's the facts of life, man. I'm sorry. There's one set of facts here. There's another set of facts here. And we could you know, collect this set and we could collect that set. And then we have to try to sort of like reconcile. And that's a challenge. We don't deny one set of facts. Oh, that's wrong. I mean, sometimes the answer may be that there was a mistaken, you know, observation. Okay, that's all possible. But many times it's not true. And many times, you know, as I remember hearing from my father, must be 30-something years ago. For whoever is not aware, my father worked for NASA from 1961 until 1985. He worked with Israel Aircraft for around 5 years, then worked as a contractor with NASA. So I consider my father quite a scientist as much as anyone else out there who's around. Anyway, so he was, you know, like that when they sent, I don't remember which probe, they sent a certain probe to Saturn, one of the first or second or third, one of the early ones. And the office, he says, the office was just up in arms today. I said, about what? He said, well, they sent back images of a braided ring of Saturn. A braided ring. So I said, okay, nice, that's nice. He said, no, it's not nice. That does not work with the laws of gravity. It's not physically possible for that to have happened. Yet it happened. And I'm not sure what the terrence is in yeshivas. What was the reconciliation? And you might not even have one. And you could come up with a lot of fantastic theories, but who knows? Because that's a fact. That question, which is very deep and difficult, it's an iceberg because we only have the observation now. And we obviously don't know, you know, in scientific terms, it happened millions of years ago or maybe even more. How did it happen? We don't know. Everything else in the universe is working with laws of gravity. This seems not to be like what's going on. Anyway, okay, that's just an example. That's an example of every field. There's bodies of evidence and there are problems in reconciling the bodies of evidence with each other. And that's normative. And there's a concept now that I want to, you know, briefly go through. I call it hierarchy of sciences. One of my Torah Shraga Talmidim says to me, I don't know if I told him this or I told him something. He says, Rabbi, you're a science snob. I said, okay, it could be. Okay, it sort of works like this. You know, if we put mathematics at the top and then we'll take physics and medicine, those are real sciences. Okay, that's how they are. I'm not trying to insult anybody. I hope any psych major, whoever hears this, doesn't get so mad that he like slams it down and says, Rabbi, you're out of your mind. I mean, I once had one of my Shraga students who was a psych major tell me that his professor told him that psychology is the epitome of science. So in Machshava, I understand what the guy's saying, but I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm all for psychologists, for the records. Now, the facts are like this, though. Let me tell you something. And this Rabbi David confirmed that I observed on my own. Rabbi David said, yeah, you know, he said, yeah, I've seen the same thing. He said, regular doctors, they think psychiatrists are playing games. Psychiatrists think that psychologists are playing games. And I'm going to tell you now, my father's a rocket scientist. He says that doctors are sometimes playing games. And with that now, I'll tell you the legendary story of sorts that my parents had about 20-ish years ago or so. I'll try to make the story short, but it's a great one. My parents were here Pesach, and again, I'm making the story short. They were exposed to hepatitis. About 5 weeks later, my mother was shopping, and she collapsed in a shopping center. And someone goes over to her pocketbook and gets out numbers and figures out how to call my father. Could be they had cell phones already. I don't remember that detail. And he comes on down. And as he says, yeah, they put her right into the ambulance. And I said, where are you taking my wife? They said, your wife collapsed. We got to take her to the hospital. They take her to the hospital. He drives right behind her. They get into the hospital. The doctor says to her, Mr. Winstein, this is really, your wife collapsed. It could be anything. It could be her heart. It could be her mind. It could be a heart attack, a stroke, anything. It could. So my father says to the doctor, says, maybe you should check for hepatitis. So the doctor says, why in the world do you think your wife has hepatitis? He says, well, we were in Israel Passover time about a little over a month ago, 5 weeks ago or so, and we were exposed. So the doctor says, 14 to 28 day incubation period. You're well after that now, mister. There is no way this is hepatitis. So my father says, you're running a blood test, aren't you? He says, yeah. We're going to run a blood test. Of course, we've got to run a blood test. He says, just do me a favor and check off hepatitis. Doctor says back, 14 to 28 day incubation period. No way it's hepatitis. So my father, as I say, he pulls out his rocket scientist card and says, listen, young man, I'm a rocket scientist. I worry about one sigma. That means something that happens one in a million times. We know she was exposed to hepatitis. You know that you have to run a blood test. Do me a personal favor and check her for hepatitis. It was hepatitis. Okay, so I'm not, again, if I say I'm for listening to psychologists and psychiatrists, definitely. Doctors, even past that. But it doesn't mean everything said is absolute. You know, when you take the 101 course, they present all the theories as absolute reality and absolute truth. And it's just not true. And I don't want to diverge more because I want to get onto the main topic. But my standard proof to this is the triple entente never existed. And if anyone who listens to this hears it and wants to know, they should PM me and I'll explain that to them. It did not exist. And you have to teach it to high school students. And maybe even in 101 level, they do that also. I'm not sure when they actually inform you that there's no such thing really as a triple entente. But whatever. Let me show that. The point is now we're getting down into softer sciences. Psychology. Those are more complicated. And when we get to history, archaeology, I have it all the time. It hasn't happened in a little while, but every so often I get it. Rabbi, what do you do about this? Oh, it's archaeology. This is stuff that you don't understand. Let me know. I've been, Baruch Hashem, had the great schus of saying Anach Yomi, you know, basically associated with Torah Shraga since Pesach, basically. And I have the great honor of having Rabbi Barnea Sullivan participate. Rabbi Barnea Sullivan is a very prominent tour guide, one of the, you know, from the top of the industry. Very deeply educated. I believe he has at least a BA, if not an MA, in archaeology. Very well read and understood about it. And this is a direct quote now, because we were talking about placement and identification. And he also confirmed, I had this theory for years, and I was happy to get professional confirmation. He says to me, "Aren't you don't get it. No. Absolute confirmation of the geographical identification of any site in Tanakh is so rare. There's about five places we know, and that's it. Everything else, we're just guessing." So what am I supposed to tell you? You know, you ask questions on archaeology, and I can't resist this because, as we say, I've got a captive audience. Anyone who thinks the archaeological proof that Murax is Tchelus is close to Avada, is close to certain, obviously knows very little about archaeology. Obviously. And I don't want to, I say that Rabbi Yashav Zatzal had a lot of siyata dishmaya. And that's what he says in his tshuva. He says, archaeologists say, people tell me this, who says if they're right or wrong, which is whatever, definitely. And it's not even in halachic terminology a suffik hashakul, which means a 50-50 question. Anyway, okay, weiter. Now let's try to get on to the main topic. Now the question we have to deal with here is, what do we deal and how are we going to, you know, we have our hierarchy of sciences. And again, you know, there's not going to be conflict between medicine and psychology. That doesn't happen. Now, as Rabbi Dr. Apfel told me in a conversation, can't remember which one, he says to me, yeah, you know, there is a problem that doctors, especially adult doctors, like to ignore psychology. And it's definitely a problem. But in other words, it's not a direct problem. In other words, if you're suffering from whatever you're suffering from, your psychology is going to dictate how you're dealing with it. It's not going to confuse the issue per se. Over here, we're now talking about somewhat, you know, confrontation between different things. And the topic and the core of the problem all touches down to, do I see Torah as an absolute reality? Because you have to. I mean, that's an important, that's a life, that's nothing. This is like, I mean, I'll quote Rabbi Meir. I don't know if anyone out there remembers Rabbi Meir. No? Okay. Rabbi Meir taught in Torah Shraga for around 8 or 9 years. It was a great honor to have him and the staff. I enjoy him intensely because he learned in yeshivot that I have no connection to, Shavei Chevron and Har Hamor, and I had no real insider connection to those places. Now I do. It's great. I just recently got a question. Someone told me they heard a certain statement from Shem Rav Kook, and I said, sounds funny, but I know exactly who to speak to because Rav Kook is a very easy person to misunderstand. Anyway, Rabbi Meir told me the following statement. I'm not trying to scare anyone off. This challenge of understanding and looking at Torah as reality, to quote Rabbi Meir, that takes 10 years. That's a 10-year life project. 5 years to get the shtuyot of America out of your mind, and another 5 years to get Torah into your mind. Okay, I'm not as machmer as he is per se, but that it's a life project, and that it's not something that we're going to solve instantaneously is true. Now, it depends what type of mind you have. You know, people who are blessed or have the burden of having a more scientific mind have a greater problem with a challenge like this. People who have a less scientific mind have less problem. They go to Emunas Chachamim very quickly. And Emunas Chachamim is a very important topic, which there's no way to talk about tonight, because it's night here. I don't know if you can't quite see it outside, but it's a complicated topic, Emunas Chachamim. That means accepting what wise people say. And whenever you go to a doctor, you're using it. Everyone has to use it a significant amount of time in their life, and there's nothing to do about it. And you know, natural intellectuals don't always like that. So, but that's how life is. This is life. Anyway, okay. We have to see Torah as reality. And I'm now going to tell you, I'm going to explain the different ways, what you do to, you know, see Torah as reality. Because it's very, very important. It's very important. Because in other words, once I see Torah as reality and I have a question, then I'm asking the question in the right way. It's sort of like, let's like step back. Like I'm saying now, my Nach Yomi is in the middle of Tehillim. And I'm very dedicated to Rashi. And when I had the great schus of doing this in Yeshiva Smir, 15 and 16, the 2 years before I was in Torah Shraga, which is around 15 and 16 years ago, maybe it's 14 and 15, it's hard to remember already, it's a long time ago, I came up with the following phrase. See, I theorized that you could come up with an approach to every mizmor, every psalm, every chapter. Mizmor is the right term for it. In Tehillim, you could come up with a thematic approach based on Rashi. I wasn't sure. I had learned it already. I'm the type of brisker maniac, per se, who doesn't like to say a shir on something unless I feel I actually know it. A lot of people are not like that. What am I supposed to say? I make my own life difficult. That's how I am. What am I supposed to do? It's my scientific background, per se. Anyway, so I said, you will be able to understand every single mizmor thematically based on Rashi. And I was able to prove you could do it. Now, the point is like this. There are times when there's a lot of questions. I have this question. Rashi says this. That is really funny. You know, as I was discussing, you know my neighbor Rabbi Machus? Anyone know my neighbor Rabbi Machus? Okay, we know who he is. I was once discussing an interesting Rashi in Kailas with him, and he says to me, "What? Are you sure Rashi is saying that?" I said, "Yeah, I'll open up and show you, Rabbi." He said, "But it's not Pshuto Shel Mikra." I said to him, Rashi apparently thought that it was. You know, Rashi considered this Pshuto Shel Mikra. And there's a lot of times when the problem's there. And it's not, you know, certain people in the Torah world, many times in the Chassidish part of it, they have a hashkafa. We don't ask questions on the Holy Rashi, which is a very beautiful thing that they have such beautiful Minas Chachamim. The thing is, if you don't ask questions, you don't come up with the answers. And you're not going to plumb, and you're not going to touch the depth of Rashi. And I would be a mechutzav to tell you I've touched all the depth of Rashi, because I certainly haven't. But fighting with Rashi and Tehillim and Kehelas and Shir Shirim, it wasn't such a fight. It was just breathtaking. But fighting with the Rashi, that's how you get to the bottom of it. But you have to accept both as reality. It's not that if I say Rashi's crazy, he doesn't know what he's talking about, then I leave it. Because what does this guy know? See, I just know so much about Rashi. As I say, if you're faithful to Rashi, Rashi be faithful to you. And you'll be surprised. Wow, Rashi's penetration of Torah in its way is unparalleled. It's unparalleled. It's incredible. Whenever I say this, I always say, we can't say more than the Ramban says. And that is Mukhtar B'Bi Musa, B'Mikra of Mishnah B'Gemara. Rashi is crowned by his achievement through the entirety of Torah. Incredible. So the point is when we have this question, we have to, it's the point of departure for us needs to be that we see the sugya, we see Rashi, whatever we're working at, as a reality. We have a question. So how do you reconcile with this? Okay, good question. Question's legitimate. The question was, sometimes there are times when we see something which we can't reconcile. Now, as a radical example, I want to show you something that confirms I saw a documentary on a plane in the last 2 years that came out. I didn't have time. I think I did Google it properly. And there are people who really say it. I mean, documentaries are very dangerous. I want you to understand. They present things beautifully, but you can't touch the core of the fact when you watch a documentary. And we're very impressionable by the visual audio medium. And I don't like that as a way to absorb fact. I don't personally. Anyway, it's sort of like this. We know that Hannibal, the Carthaginian general, famously brought elephants into the Italian peninsula. I mean, let me put it to you this way. There's no known archaeological, clear, absolute archaeological evidence to it, but it was recorded both by Hannibal and by the Romans. And there's no one out there that I'm aware of who doubts that happened. No one. There is indirect circumstantial evidence on the victory coins the Romans printed after Hannibal's defeat that had pictures of elephants on it. That's circumstantial evidence. Okay. Now, I always had this theory, and I saw it confirmed in this documentary, that they were African elephants. I'm just going to leave it simple. To say they were Asian elephants makes so little sense. I'm not even going to bother with it. Because, whatever, it just does not make sense. Now, the Greek elephants of Hanukkah were Asian elephants. And Asian elephants are domesticated till today. African elephants today are not domesticated. However, clearly in Hannibal's times they were. Clearly. Now, I just can't resist. Rabbi Slifkin, in my personal opinion, spoke in a disrespectful fashion about Tosus. When Tosus talks about making an elephant jump, the elephants we see today cannot jump. Well, you know what I say? Well, that's the Asian elephants. But what about the domesticated African elephants of 2,000 years ago? Maybe they could jump. Maybe. Who knows? Maybe it was a species that doesn't exist anymore. Maybe. Anyway, that's just a, this is a, you know, when we talk about a topic like this, there's a tone of respect, even when our perception of fact completely goes against what it says in an early source, we have to maintain a respectful tone. That's very important. But again, it's beyond the scope of this cheer to properly explain when and where and how. That's complicated. But a respectful tone we have to maintain, and we have to see Torah as reality. Now, I want to go now and give two examples of how I see what I see and how I see Torah's reality. Okay, one example, and I have to thank Ehud Barak for this. Ehud Barak was Prime Minister of Israel for around 2 years, late 90s until 2001 or so. He was the second worst Prime Minister Israel ever had. The worst was Ehud Olmert. He was a disaster. And I have a lot more sympathy for Barak because there's a truism that a person's life experience prepares them for where they are. There have been very few Israeli chiefs of staff, in Hebrew called Ramatkal, who did well in politics. They do well as Sar Bitachon, as Minister of Defense, because they're prepared for it. As Prime Minister, Rabin was the only one who really did well. And Barak, and the Israeli army is not the American army. You know, the American army, when the general says something, you listen. The Israeli army, it's not as true because Jews are very contentious and argumentative. But it's still much more true than in society at large. And politics means compromise. It means listening to other people, listening to people who you don't necessarily like, listening to people who you don't like at all, and that's politics. Now, Barak had a problem with it, and he didn't do it well at all because he had just finished. He had not been involved in politics long enough to get it down, and then at the time in the middle of his problems, it was Parshas Pinchas, and Moshe Rabbeinu asks Hashem to appoint a new leader on the Jewish people, and over there use a very unique terminology. He says, Hashem al kei ruchos chabasar, yivkar Hashem al kei ruchos basar ish al eida. It's in Revi of Pinchas. He says Hashem al kei ruchos chabasar. That's a very unique term. Rashi says, why does it use that? And this is a golden rule of Jewish leadership. Rashi is quoting Midrash Chazal. And for the records, a friend of mine, Rabbi Shaul Goldman, who is an incredible genius, he says Rashi never quotes any Midrash Chazal verbatim, word for word. He always says something, he always changes something, etc., something in those lines. Now, Rashi says over there, you know these people. He says to Hashem, okay, Ruch HaZuchal Basar, you know these people. They're, just like they have different faces, so too each one has their own opinion. You have to put a leader on them, a leader, Jewish leadership. It doesn't mean pushing down other people's opinions. It means working with their opinions. Because that is the what do we call it? That is the functional norm of Jews. Jews are opinionated. Jews are supposed to be opinionated. Jews are incredibly opinionated. And we're supposed to be. And Jewish leadership is not, it's not saying, no, shut up and listen. That's not Jewish leadership. Because you're not going to get anywhere. It didn't work in the Midbar. It didn't work, you know, every single historical record we have of Jews shows that we are argumentative. There were Jewish thinkers of 150 years ago or so who thought it was an aberration of you know, living in Eastern Europe, etc. That's not true. It's a functional norm. and there ain't nothing to do about it. It's something that's part of being Jewish, is having an opinion. That's how it is. Okay, so that when he was going to say, when we see some a phenomenon like this that is deeply recorded, accurately recorded in Torah, and this is just one example of many, this is a way for us to bring Torah and see Torah as a reality to us. That's an example. I'll give me another example. And that we sort of mentioned this earlier, but now we're going to mention it the right way. It's a dualism, and the dualism is explicit Radak in Tehillim Nun Gimel or so. You will never meet a person who is unopinionated about the Jewish people. Never. They don't exist. And as I say, everyone's very opinionated about Jews. Jews are the most opinionated about Jews. Everyone is very opinionated. And the parallelism to that is David HaMelech. You will never meet a person who is not extremely opinionated about David. And the Radak says, and this is my terminology, not his. He just says there's a parallelism. I say in modern terminology, in modern expression, David is a microcosm of the Jewish people. And just like everyone is incredibly opinionated about the Jews, people are just as opinionated about David. And I have had more than one time very heated arguments and debates about David. Very heated. About 20 to 25 years ago, I had a guest over from, Jeff Seidel, Meir Schuster. Alav Shalom. Satzal. Scraped off the wall, as we say. Yeah, college student visiting here. I don't know if the guy's Hebrew definitely wasn't fluent. He had not learned the entire Tanakh. He was not sure which Svarim in Tanakh David was mentioned in. And he attempted to have, I don't know if I call it a debate, because it's not a debate. I knew the stories and he didn't. He didn't, again, his Hebrew wasn't good enough to translate from the original. So what are you fighting with me about David for? But wow, he was fighting about, oh, how can you say that, Rabbi? How can you say that? David was the greatest person, one of the greatest people in the world. It's not possible. How can you? Take it easy, man. I have never seen anyone get that angry about Julius Caesar or about Alexander the Great. If I would say, no, I don't say this, but let's say I would say something like, Alexander the Great completely destroyed the world by what he did with this, this, and this, and this. Or Julius Caesar did that. Let's say I'd say one of those statements. Or Octavian, let's say, whatever, let's say I would say it. There are probably historians who say things like that. Okay, that's nice, it could be. You know what? Because we don't see that as something that's important. And when you see people have very deep reaction to David, to the Jewish people, that shows how real they really deep down intuitively understand it is. Let me just give you another parallel example. There was a tumult about 15 years ago. And I'm not going to mention names because it's not, even though it's not, there's no Isser Lashon Hara, I'm still not going to mention names because it's just not, I don't want to talk about the Shiloh. I'm bringing the question up as an example, not as Psak Halacha Lamaisa, Psak Halacha Lamaisa, go ask your local Orthodox rabbi. Ask Rabbi David, ask Rabbi Schachter, ask whoever you want. Ask someone competent, I mean. There came a question up about taking contact lenses and putting the contact lens into a solution on Shabbos and cleaning it. Is that mutter or aser on Shabbos? Are we allowed to do that on Shabbos or we're not allowed to do that on Shabbos? People get really heated about that. Look, it's a sugya. Do you know the sugya? No. Do you know where in Shulchan Aruch is brought? No. Do you know what the different Rishonim say about it? No. Do you know this part? There's, let's say, 4 to 5 important parts of the sugya that you need to know before you can open your mouth. So, can you tell me, what are you so opinionated about? Why are you so angry? No, but what do you mean? How can you say that? Slow down. Do you know anything about this? The answer is no. But see, we feel intuitively, deep down, we understand, we know Torah is real. And the reason why is, as it says in Parshas Vayelech, I think it is, Kikarav Eilecha Hadavra Ma'od Beficha Olavavcha Lasosa. Torah is close to every Jew. And that's why, in a topic like this, which if it would be nuclear science, which I don't really know anything about. My father doesn't really either. If it would be rocket science, you wouldn't try to argue with my father about rocket science. You wouldn't win anyway, but you wouldn't try because you know he knows it and you don't know it. So what are you arguing about this for? What are you arguing? You don't know where anything is. What are you arguing about? So the answer is because it's inside of you, and you know inside of you that there's you have a connection to it. So this is the this is my you know these are what I call tools. It's not a one time quick solution that now all we have to do is change our minds and everything's going to work right. We just adopt a new motto, a new slogan, and everything's smooth. It's a challenge. It's a challenge that we face. Many of us face it. Some people do. Some people don't. It depends how intellectual you are. Let's not get into, you know, that's more of like a private discussion. I mean, it could be a public discussion, but it's a long public discussion, not a short one at the end of this year when I need to finish up. And we just, you know, Rabbi Meir says it could take you 10 years. I hope it'll take you less. But it's something we have to work at. But it's very critical and important whenever we're dealing with this style and form of challenge, is to work on seeing Torah as pure reality like it is. Now, we say on Shabbos, and I always say, you know, as sort of a joke, sort of, it's not just rabbis and educators who say this. We say, V'sein chalkeinu b'sarasecha, V'tein chalkeinu b'taratecha, give us a portion in your Torah. And that means everyone has a part of Torah that they have a portion in. They do. Everyone does. Your portion of Torah could be here, it could be there. Some people are more into halacha, some people are more into chumash, some people are into kachim, some people are into this, some people are into that. There are a lot of halacha and there's a lot of parts of Torah. And I'm not trying to scare anybody, but the basics of all Torah and touching Torah is mastering. You want to know why? You know, Rav Olshan likes to say a share about this every year. I don't know if he says what I say. Maybe he probably could be says what I say. You know why? You know, as we say, why, Rabbi? Why do we learn so much Gemara? Or as one of my Shraga boys once says to me, Rabbi, this yeshiva is Gemara, 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 and more Gemara. See, I'm going to teach Nachin Tard Shraga, so he thought he'd get sympathy out of me. So I said to him, "You're still asking that question in February?" And I'll tell you why. You know why? If you want to have competence in any part of Torah, you have to have a basic kenyan of how you learn Be'iyun, of how you analyze, quotes, the data of Torah. That's what learning Be'iyun is about. As I have to analyze the data. And this is a fascinating thing. I hope this helps people. When we're teaching how to learn, even in Torah Shraga, even Shana Aleph, you're closer in touch with the reality of the Kilu scientific, Torah scientific style data than you're going to get to in college till you get to a master's level, you know, class. That's how it is. Because the body of data in Torah, it's a sugya and shas. How to process, that's how you learn Rashi and Tosis in the Rambam. Okay. When you learn it and we get a deep understanding of it, this is from the most powerful tools to see Torah as reality, and we should all be zacha to see Torah as a true reality and come up with good answers and good reconciliations for the questions we have between Torah and science.